This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our topic this week is rural electric power, and our guest, Dwayne Hiley, the CEO of the Tri-State Generation and Transmission Association. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the Soy Checkoff. Tri-State's Dwayne Hiley is next. Wanted to take a moment and talk to soybean farmers. Nearly 500,000 of you are in the U.S. growing over 4 billion bushels of soybeans a year. And the Soy Checkoff is working hard to grow demand, innovating, testing, and showcasing new uses in new industries such as firefighting foam, tires, straws, shoes, or 1,000 other products. To learn more, visit unitedsoybean.org and keep on growing. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Demand for electric power is growing across the nation in both rural and urban areas. Dwayne Hiley with the Tri-State Generation and Transmission Association says rural electric cooperatives are left with some powerful headwinds, but as well, plenty of opportunities to serve a rural customer base.
Well, you know, one of the first ones that comes to mind is just reliability. And if you look at the assessments that had been done in the last several years by the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, NERC, they've been shading in large parts of the map in red, which means bad. That means high risk of blackouts and outages in large portions of the country. And part of this is caused by an increased reliance on intermittent resources. It's also just being caused by a general not keeping up with the rate of growth we're having in terms of the addition of dispatchable generation that can meet those loads. So that's the first concern in terms of a headwind. It also presents us an opportunity, though, and at Tri-State we've really embraced this with development of new reliability metrics. But then when you think about the opportunities, the growth does bring some tremendous opportunities, and for rural America especially. If you think about rural America, we haven't had the opportunity that the urban areas have had in the last decades, but now with the growth even of data centers that can often be put in a rural area, that can bring some jobs and tax base that wouldn't otherwise be available for them. And we are seeing a higher rate of growth than we did pre-pandemic, and I'm encouraged by it. As members are investing in rural America, they're growing. I think people have discovered through the pandemic that rural America is a great place to live, and so we're seeing a lot of growth in that regard.
So how important is the Department of Agriculture's rural development funds for groups like Tri-State and others that are attempting to close the gap between rural and urban?
Well, it's extremely important for us because of our members. You know, we are a nonprofit, member-owned electric cooperative, but if you just look at cooperatives in general, we serve the largest percentage of persistent poverty counties in the United States. And it's just part of being in rural America. A lot of times that's where they're hurting the most. So we get to serve the people who sometimes have trouble paying their bills. USDA provides assistance to electric cooperatives in a number of ways to help us with meeting our member needs, to providing low interest loans for the growth that we're experiencing so that we can build out transmission to their homes, to serve these growing communities, and so that we can build generation competitively. You know, another area that's very important for us is to be able to access some of these beneficial credits and grants, because if you just look at the cost per mile for rural America to serve electricity, it's so much higher than the urban areas. You know, a typical electric cooperative in our area serves between 3 and 7 consumers per mile of line investment. But in an urban area, you can be 30 to 50 consumers per mile of line investment. And just imagine how much more cost effective that is to build infrastructure and earn a return. In fact, you know, the investor-owned utilities make money on this. But if you're in rural America, you need some help to keep power costs generally in line. I'm very proud of the record of the electric cooperatives. If you look, our rates are generally absolutely competitive with what people pay in urban areas. And yet, it's despite that, I mean, the low density. But it's because of our focus on cost, the fact that we work for members. I face a board of directors that's democratically elected representatives from every one of our member systems. These are people who pay their utility bill every month to their local electric cooperative or public power district, and they care a lot about affordability and reliability. And as a result, having them as our board and as our primary regulator means I'm always focused on cost and reliability. I don't waste money. You know, none of us here at the cooperative do. That means we're able to keep rates in line with what the people who enjoy much greater density can do.
It's been several weeks ago, but Jim Matheson of NRECA was with us, and we were talking about the energy situation in the nation of having an adequate base load for the day, but also in meeting the need of that base load, and at the same time having the transmission infrastructure to carry more electric power to serve an increased need for electricity. A tremendous challenge. Is it the same in the West?
It is, and more so. Just you look at the density again, and we have 6,000 miles of transmission to serve these members across 200,000 square miles of territory, some of the most rugged and difficult to access areas. We recently had an outage on the top of Ophir Pass. It's probably the tallest transmission structure in the country, somewhere around 12,000 feet elevation. And we had to send linemen up on foot to go get to that transmission tower and fix a guy wire that had come loose that was causing a problem. So, I mean, it's challenging. But and the other problem with transmission is just we need transmission today, and you can't do any kind of energy transition, whether it's a green energy transition or just trying to make the current grid more reliable. You've got to have more transmission, but it can take anywhere from 5 to 15 years just to get your permit to get started. I know there's talk of legislation that will help improve permitting, and we really favor that. We'd love to see something like that in the future farm bill that would say, let's get where we don't have to wait 15 years to build. It'd be like, you know, the next superhighway. You've already got a congested highway, and you need to build a new highway, but you're going to wait 15 years just to get the permit before you can even get started. That's just not acceptable for us when everybody is wanting to electrify everything, and there's benefits to electrification, and yet as you do that, you're going to eventually need that additional superhighways to move that power around.
So how do you see demand is going to increase among the customers that you serve over the next 3, 5, 10, 15 years?
You know, in the past, we were looking at rates of growth of around 2% a year, just as pre-pandemic. And it's at least double that, if not more. In this past year, year-to-date, we were looking at as much as nearly 7% growth in 1 year. Now, I don't know that that's going to be sustained, but it is. It's first of all, encouraging because we like to see rural America growing, and that's our customer base, our member base. But at the same time, it brings new challenges. We have to build new generation, which many people don't want in their backyard, no matter what kind of generation it is. Even green energy is facing opposition these days. And then you have to have the transmission to deliver it all to where it needs to go. So both of those are long lead time items. We're building resources today that we believe will be serving our children and grandchildren. This business has always been a long duration business where we invest for decades, not just for the next few years. So there's plenty of challenges all the way around.
What are the sources of increased demand?
The one you hear the most about is AI and data centers, and that is very much a concern for everybody in the electric business today because some very well-funded investors come in and say, we want to put the equivalent of a very large city, add that in, and how quick can you do it? Can you have it online by next year? So, 500 megawatts, 1,000 megawatts of load, that's like a very large city. And that's just not something you can do that quickly, no matter what kind of will you have to do it. You can get the data center built. You just can't necessarily get the infrastructure built. But, a big part of what we're seeing out here is good old load growth because the economy is doing so much better. A lot of oil and gas development that's growing up, a lot of people just being more prosperous and running their businesses more. I think it's very encouraging, the signs we're seeing, because it's a growth kind of all across. Definitely EVs is a part of that. But I'd say the economy in general is the biggest driver. And then we do have these, I'd say, sometimes almost frightening conversations where you say, how am I going to serve this data center that wants such a massive amount of energy to fuel their AI project?
How has the nation's war on coal impacted electric generation? And what are sources that are reliable that can help meet this demand?
That is a fantastic question and one we've been putting squarely in front of our regulators. So if you think about Tri-State, and we're serving members in four states, but two of those states feel differently about energy than the other two. So we've got New Mexico and Colorado that have very ambitious clean energy goals as a state. And they require the utilities to deliver higher and higher percentages of clean energy to customers in Colorado and New Mexico. But then you take Wyoming and Nebraska, and they feel differently about that. Wyoming would like to see coal keep stay in the mix as long as possible. There's a lot of mining jobs there, and they're definitely much in favor of oil and gas. So as we have our members come together at our board table, and we're trying to decide how we're going to serve our members in the decades to come and their kids and grandkids, it all comes down to reliability and affordability. And really, we try not to politicize this energy transition. What we've discovered is that we're so blessed with really high-quality renewables out here. We have some great solar resources, especially in New Mexico and in southern Colorado. We have some great wind resources in eastern Colorado and in western Wyoming. And those resources end up being the lowest-cost energy on our system. And so that puts coal at a disadvantage. And so some of the issues with coal are definitely because people are trying to issue legislative edicts to shut it down. But another big part of the story that doesn't get talked about very much is just the economics of coal. Since we've developed fracking gas and gas prices have come down, we have so much abundant natural gas. Gas competes, at least in our area, very much against coal to the point at which it's hard to keep a coal plant running. And Tri-State actually took action to close the plant in New Mexico solely based on economics. We couldn't afford to continue to run it when we had other resources that were cheaper. So it's a complex question. It's not just as simple as somebody passed a law to close coal, because sometimes it's really, if we're going to be providing the most reliable and affordable power for our members, how are we going to do that? And it might mean we close a facility that was formerly a baseload facility. But then the immediate question is, how are you going to keep the lights on if you don't have that baseload plant that formerly was there? And as we look at Tri-State's transition, it involves a mix of renewables that just provide low-cost energy but don't actually, we never rely on them to serve load during critical weather periods. But the modeling we've done says we'll keep natural gas in the mix for as long as we can see into the future, because it's a resource that you can run during those very difficult periods, weather periods. And also, long-duration storage batteries, and when I say long-duration, a lot of utilities are deploying batteries that can discharge for 4 hours or 2 hours. We're looking at a battery that can discharge over 100 hours, made in America, iron air technology, so again, not relying on rare earth metals, and to us, that's a critical part of the future grid as we imagine a grid that doesn't have the same level of fossil fuel base load. And we have to replace something that has the equivalent reliability, and that's long-duration storage batteries is part of that answer.
I noted from some information about Tri-State that in 2021, already 34% of your energy came from clean resources, wind, solar, and hydro. And you have some pretty lofty goals looking ahead to next year and even by 2030.
We're grateful that we finally got Congress to pass direct pay tax credits. So we were at a disadvantage against the for-profit investor-owned utilities serving urban areas. They were able to take advantage of tax credits for wind and solar. But as a nonprofit cooperative, even though we're sitting in an area that's blessed with abundant wind and solar resources, we couldn't get that tax credit. And because we don't pay taxes, we're a nonprofit. And so we finally got direct pay tax credits passed, and the NRECA was a big part of lobbying for that, our trade association. As a result now, we're building our own solar projects. That means we get the benefits, our members get the benefits. It's money they don't have to spend out of their pocket. And we will be deploying those. They'll come online in 2025. And by the end of 2025, we'll be at 50% clean energy for all of our members across all four states. And then if you look at the continued development of just taking advantage of this wonderful wind and solar resource we have, coupling that with long-duration storage batteries to keep it reliable, and keeping fossil fuels in the mix, by the end of the decade, we anticipate being at 70% clean energy across all four states. So the majority of energy consumed by our members will be coming from wind and solar and hydro, and that's a real benefit for them because the cost of those resources, again, in our area at least, is extremely competitive with fossil fuels.
So as demand grows, will your transition to clean sources give you a reliable base load that can meet that demand?
Yeah, and this is where we've done so much work, and especially driven by our members in Wyoming. I mean, we will be keeping coal running in Wyoming, but we're going to be using it less and less as a smaller portion of the mix over time. And so their concern was, what happens when it's an extreme weather day, a winter storm like Storm Uri, which frankly was the scariest time in my career as a utility person. And so if that happens again, what do we do? Now, what we saw during Storm Uri was wind quit blowing, not just in one state, but across multiple states. And in the wintertime, our members' peak energy use occurs during times when the sun is not shining. So people get up in the morning, 7 a.m., we have a peak just as the sun is rising. And again, when people come home from work, 6 p.m., we're having a peak in energy usage. But again, there's no sunshine then. So we said, no matter what you think about an energy transition, you're not going to be using wind and solar to serve load. And we developed what we call level two reliability metrics through extreme weather modeling that proved mathematically that if we can keep some fossil fuels in the mix, we don't need them often, but when we need them, we really need them. So we just can't close all those plants. We have to keep them open, and we'll run them during those periods like a Storm Uri, and couple that with the long-duration storage batteries that give us the equivalent of a coal stockpile, basically, and then keeping some fossil fuels in the mix. We won't use as much, but during extreme weather periods, we'll still need it.
As you look to meeting demand in the future and opportunities for resources, is there a way to use coal that would not be as detrimental to the environment and carbon and greenhouse gases?
Absolutely. And if you just look at some of the funding like Tri-State's receiving, some of our colleagues are sponsoring a carbon capture and storage project on a coal plant. Minn Kota is the G&T, the Generation Transmission Cooperative, sponsoring that project with funding from the federal government through USDA. So it's an opportunity to prove that you can take the carbon dioxide emissions and reduce them significantly. I think it's 90%, something like that. And so you have a large coal plant that provides baseload energy, but it has the emissions of some tiny little natural gas-based plant. It's attractive technology. Tri-State was part of the Integrated Test Center in Wyoming, Dry Fork Station. So it's kind of a test bed for this technology back when it was first developed.
Dwayne, in prime areas of the Midwest, there is a battle, if you will, over land use and whether wind turbines or whether solar fields replace crops. In the West, are you finding it easier to embrace natural and clean resources of energy without having such an impact on the agriculture base?
I think so, and I think part of it's just the resource we're blessed with. So a lot of our good solar resource occurs in areas that are effectively high desert, so it's not good agri-production areas. And so we can take advantage of that and have to serve our members with some very low-cost solar that doesn't impact ag. And then if you think about wind, and specifically in eastern Colorado, which is a great ag production area, the wind towers coexist very well with the ag operations there. And the farmers and ranchers actually welcome them because it's an additional revenue stream that helps stabilize their cash flows. Every month they're getting a check from that wind farm or from that wind tower that's on their property. Then they can still continue to do their ag operations in the vicinity of those towers. It's a good, peaceful coexistence.
So earlier this year, the Department of Agriculture announces the ERA, Empowering Rural America, willing to finance $2.5 billion worth of work inside your service area. How critical are these dollars, and how are these dollars going to be resourced?
This is really a wonderful program for our rural residents. Our farmers and ranchers are going to benefit directly from this because every dollar that comes in helps reduce costs that they would otherwise have to spend on their power supply. And it's going to help us, first of all, meet some of the state mandates we have for energy transition. But it also helps us meet those more reliably and more affordably. So we can add more of these long-duration storage batteries. That's one of the things that's being sponsored through this funding. It's helping our members with stranded costs related to fossil fuel plants that would otherwise operate to serve their load. And it's helping them accelerate an energy transition that provides really good cost resources that are fixed. If you think about what this means for power bills going forward, and I mentioned earlier that Tri-State will be at 70% clean energy provided to our members by the end of this decade. Well, those resources that provide clean energy, hydro, wind, and solar, are really fixed cost resources that you pay for once, and then you get to enjoy energy from them for decades to come. So that means our members' power bills will be less volatile, less responsive to changes in natural gas prices or oil prices. So that it's a good transition for them. And another key element of this new era funding is that the large majority of what we're receiving is through low interest rate loans, which will be paid back to the federal government. But it provides our members the ability with a massive capital investment program as we go through this transition and to get low cost financing for that. And it means that their kids and grandkids aren't burdened with high interest rates to pay back those costs for those projects that were built.
What do you think other co-ops can learn from your investment and experience in meeting the needs of your customers?
Well, I think we're trying to show that you can make these transitions and keep it reliable and affordable. I mean, that's been the big fear, is that the lights will go out or the rates will skyrocket. And I think here at Tri-State, we've been able to prove both of those aren't true. I mean, with our modeling, we're showing that we're going to actually be more reliable at the end of the decade with the resources we're deploying and the way we're deploying them, with, you know, a combination of long-duration batteries and keeping fossil fuels in the mix for those emergency times. And in terms of affordability, since 2017, we've had one rate increase, and we've had two rate decreases. And if you look at our total increase in cost since 2017, it's less than 2% in terms of rate impact. And I'm just not sure of another utility that can say that. They've been a whole cost that tight, and we're doing that as we're adding lots of renewables to the mix, and partly we're blessed with some great wind and solar. That's just where we are in the country.
So, Duane, as we look to the future, whether from the state houses or from the White House or on Capitol Hill, what is needed, either less of regulation or more of legislation? What can state houses and Washington do to help the nation provide more clean energy as our energy demand grows?
So there's probably three things I'd highlight here. And the first one is, on the regulatory side, a recognition that we can't transition this grid to majority renewables without threatening reliability. So we have done modeling that we're sharing broadly with national and international organizations, including the regulatory utility commissioners. I think it's been well received, but we'd like to see this enhanced level of reliability that we're showing, that we're proving out here in our system, to be adopted nationwide, because we think it will result in a more reliable grid. This is what we call level two reliability metrics based on extreme weather modeling. And that does mean keeping fossil fuels in the mix, even as you add massive amounts of renewables. So that's the first thing I'd say, is on the regulatory side, some reform on how you measure reliability and how you hold utilities accountable. The next thing would be permitting reform in terms of how quickly we can get these projects built, both generation and transmission. And don't forget, transmission is just as important as generation. And it can just take decades to get these projects built, and we have to have the ability to cut through that and put things online quickly so we can support this growing economy. And the other one I'd mention that we haven't talked about yet today is wildfire. And some concerns there is that every utility today is just one spark away from bankruptcy. We've seen this repeatedly now with arid areas in the West and how readily wildfires can be started. And so we're looking for some assistance in liability protection, maybe a national fund that would be there so that you don't just, it's just not in the public interest that if through no fault of the utility who's doing good practices, but something blows into a line or sparks and starts a fire, and now we have massive losses, and no utility wants that. But if we're going to meet some standard, we should be able to get some protection. It's become the case today that it's nearly impossible for a utility to insure against this risk, which means that if there is a fire, the utility's gone. And that's just not in the public interest to have their local provider be bankrupt.
Well, Duane Holley, we want to thank you very much for being with us on this edition of Open Mic. And it's really tremendous to see the example that Tri-State Generation and Transmission is setting by recognizing that there is an increased demand coming for electricity and looking for every available means to see it grow. And really not in such a way that is a threat to fossil fuels, but including an all-of-the-above strategy. Thanks for being here. This is Open Mic, and today, sir, you have the last word.
Well, thank you, Jeff. I've really enjoyed our time together. You know, I guess what I'd leave us with is I think the co-op business model is really the best regulatory model for making an energy transition like this. I get to face people from the end of the line who write the checks, who pay the bills, that care a lot about their power. And what they want is it to be reliable and affordable. Now, a green energy transition is kind of a bonus on top of that, but for the most part, we talk about reliability and affordability. And I think what we're showing here at Tri-State is that we can increase the amount of green energy without jeopardizing reliability, because we're going to keep fossil fuels in the mix for those critical weather days. And yet we can also do it affordably, because some of these resources really come in at some of the lowest costs on our system. So why not embrace both? The low-cost wind and solar, the reliability of the fossil fuels, and we can bring all that together in our system. Again, because we work for the member at the end of the line and we're not interested in making a profit on this, I think that's why it works so well for us. Thank you, Jeff, again for having me with you.
Our thanks to Dwayne Hiley, the CEO of Tri-State Generation and Transmission Association, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the Soy Checkoff. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nellie.